last 100 years, Hartford's gone from being the richest city in the country to the poorest. The city's in crisis, from public education to public safety. The question for Hartford today is, have we reached the bottom? Is Hartford turning around?
Welcome to Hartford 2020, a weekly program on the problems and opportunities facing the city of Hartford. On this program, you'll hear politicians and community activists, scholars and gadflies, and people from across Hartford's many communities sharing with us their candid opinions about how Hartford reached this point and where it's going. I'm Jay Hughes, Associate Director of Institutional Research and Planning at Trinity College.
And I'm Ivan Kuzik, the Director of the city's Data Center at Trinity College. Stay tuned for an hour exploring the future of Hartford. Elizabeth Horton Scheff is a nationally prominent member of the Green Party and is currently majority leader on the Hartford City Council. She's been active politically in the Hartford area for over 2 decades and has worked on a range of issues from AIDS to war. She was first elected to the council as a Democrat in 1991. In the last 2 elections, she ran and won as a Green. She plans to seek re-election this fall. Ms. Scheff is also the mother of Milo Scheff, perhaps the best-known plaintiff in the Scheff versus O'Neill lawsuit. The Scheff case, which forced the state of Connecticut to accept the responsibility to remedy racial segregation and poor performance in Hartford schools, was settled earlier this year. The interview with Ms. Scheff was recorded on June 16, 2003, at Hartford City Hall. Well, you know, I mean, where to begin? 30 years in politics in Hartford. How did you get into politics?
Well, you know, I never thought about being an elected official. Now, being engaged in politics, being a community activist, that's a part of parcel. But how I got to be an elected official is when Carrie Saxton Perry decided that she wanted her own slate of Democrats. And I'm a recovering Democrat. She went around and asked various community organizations who out there is a good person to run, and my name came up on several radar screens. So, you know, Madam Mayor and I sat down and we talked about it, and that's how I got to be an elected official.
Mm-hmm. Now, that was the council race in, would have been 87, right?
That was 87, 91.
91. So mm-hmm. Was that the People for Change slate?
No, that was when we ran, we had a moment in time. It was just one of those windows that you really wish you can have every day, but really only come every 20 or 30 years. But it was 6 Democrats and the 3 People for Change. So actually it was a 9-person race.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you've been active in community politics before that?
In community politics, yeah.
Mm-hmm. As an activist with different organizations?
Working on public housing issues, issues relating to persons living with HIV/AIDS, South Africa divestment, and when the height of the apartheid movement, anti-apartheid movement, hunger, homelessness. I mean, you know, I've been out there for a while, just generally addressing injustices and... That's who I am.
Well, back then you had already, your son was already a plaintiff then from 89 in the Scheff case.
Yes.
So can you explain sort of how that whole case began? I mean, how, you know, Scheff sort of underlies every aspect of public education in the mm-hmm. region now, and mm-hmm. it's been dragging on since 89. And I was reading in the paper that you think that this final finding by the court and the settlement is really just the beginning.
Oh,
I'm
very
wondering,
much so.
For a lot of people who haven't followed the news, who aren't aware, I mean, mm-hmm. can you briefly take us sort of how the case started and sort of how you see it sort of meandering through the courts for the last almost 15 years now?
Yeah, it's been a while, hasn't it? The legal team, particularly John Britton,
yeah.
who was dean of Thurgood Marshall School of Law, and was a former professor of law at the UConn School of Law. Martha Stone, who was then the director of the CCLU, she's now is the director of the Child Advocacy Project at UConn. And John Charles Boger, who was then the director from the NAACP Inc. Fund. They actually brought a group of people together to talk, community people together, to talk about the status of education in Hartford. For 2 years prior to that meeting, Martha and John had been gathering data on the increasing racial isolation, the increasing disparity in resources, the increasing unequal access to good integration, quality integrated education. So actually, here we go again. I was at the time vice president of the Westbrook Village Tennis Association. I lived in public housing. And the person who was asked to attend the meeting was the president. Right? Her name was her name is Barbara Fowler. She was afraid to go. And so she asked me to attend in her stead. So at divine intervention, I went. So, and at that meeting, I learned that 74% of children in the eighth grade needed assistance with remedial reading. 74%. Now, if you're in the eighth grade and you cannot read, what is your life going to be? Okay, if you can't read and you're in the eighth grade, and 74% is a systems number. It's not 74% of the children were failing. It's the system was failing 74%. So, I mean, I went back and talked to Milo, poor little Milo. I mean, I used to drag Milo around to, you know, AIDS vigils and marches on Washington. So he would go to community meetings. And I actually talked to Milo about participating in this suit. And we went together to the next meeting. He agreed to join. The lawyers interviewed all the people who signed up to be plaintiffs. They chose 10 families, had another round of interviews, and then they chose Milo and me to be named plaintiffs. But, you know, since 1989, it's been a struggle in and out of the courts. We've seen racial isolation increase. At the same time, we've seen the state of Connecticut refuse to get off what I call the Bart Simpson defense. It wasn't me. You can't prove it. But finally, in 1996, after Harry Hammer in the lower court did such a terrible ruling on the Sheff lawsuit and the tenets of the case, the Supreme Court picked us right up, and you know we were successful in the Supreme Court to address the violation of our children's constitutional rights. And I say, you know, when I started out, I never did this for my son. I knew Milo wouldn't, you know, come on, you know, I say. But I did it for our children, and we still are doing it, and we're still working on it for our children. But we need to be clear that Sheff is more than a lawsuit. Sheff is a movement and a lawsuit. And we've been always working from that dichotomy. While we have the lawsuit in the courts, we have been working in the streets to address quality integrated education, equal educational access. And so a lot of the gains that have been made around early childhood education, saving the accreditation of Weaver, Hartford, Buckley, the interdistrict quote unquote Sheff grants that bring children from various racial ethnic backgrounds together, the constant conversation on race and class that is occurring in our state, that needs to occur in our state. These are things that come from the movement, Sheff. We have an agreement with the state of Connecticut just recently. And it is the first time that the state of Connecticut has actually said, okay, we have to fix this. And there are measurable goals. There are timelines. Something that the state has long resisted. So is it what we envisioned 14 years ago? Of course not. Is it a good start? Yes, it is a good start. Will we be still at it? Yes, we'll still be at it. The emphasis is to one day see every school in the city of Hartford of magnet school quality. And actually, magnet schools are a manifestation of the Sheff lawsuit. So, I mean, while people say, oh, you know, you didn't do that lawsuit didn't do anything, you're still working. The lawsuit produced a whole lot of social change.
Now, you mentioned sort of the discussion on race and class.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if I'm not mistaken, the first Supreme Court decision in 94 that went against the plaintiffs actually said this is an issue of class, not of race.
And well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, this is just kind of my sort of cursory reading. Mm-hmm. And the interplay, the interweave of race and class is such that, you know, Hartford schools are more racially isolated than they were 10 years ago when the Sheff case began.
You know, the schools in Hartford are racially isolated just the same as the schools in Glastonbury are racially isolated. Okay. And, you know, Chaplin,
Connecticut.
You know, Connecticut, racially isolated. So, you know, it's a matter of people always say, oh, what a wonderful thing you did for those children of color. Oh, this is great. But you know, the children who are white and segregated are just at the same disadvantage when they grow up and get into the workplace and try to live in the real world. They're just as disadvantaged.
Right.
We here in the urban centers and in the rural pockets of our state have an additional burden because we have less of money to deal with things like, you know, pretty curtains on the wall and books and, you know, the base necessities. But I believe that the disadvantage is shared when it comes to racial isolation.
I guess my question is that I wonder in its solution to integrate whether the state can still, you know, I forget the numbers on how many Hartford youth will actually be sort of served by, you know, magnet type schools, whether by agreeing to look for that solution, whether the state hasn't sort of got off the hook for having to provide every kid in Hartford with a quality education.
Well, the state of Connecticut is still responsible for education. Okay? The state of Connecticut, by constitution, is responsible for the education of every child in the state. The state chooses to, what is that word when you give it to somebody? I can't think of the word.
Redistribute?
No, what is the word? Delegate.
Delegate.
Okay. They choose to delegate their responsibility to cities and towns, but ultimately, constitutionally, they're responsible. The city is still working with the state, City of Hartford, still working with the state on the base issues of improving Hartford schools. So it's not an either or. So people want to say it's either Hartford school system or it's the magnet schools. No, I mean, this is one in the same. We have to work at raising magnet schools at the same time we talk about raising the quality of all Hartford schools.
Well, now you're on the inside. You're at the city government. I mean, are you still optimistic that these changes could be made?
Well, yes. You know why? Because I believe in higher power. And, you know, 14 years ago, people said, oh, this is not going to work. There's nothing going to happen. It's going to be, you know, you're wasting your time. And, you know, if I did not believe that things could change, then I think it would be a very sad world. If we are willing to stay in a negative situation simply because we're too tired or, you know, it's hopeless and, you know, all that apathy that people try to cling to keep in a comfort zone. I think that's sad. Me, I believe that we can live in a better world. But I believe that it's up to us to make that better world.
You're listening to an interview with Elizabeth Horton Sheff, majority leader of the Hartford City Council and a member of the Green Party, on Hartford 2020.
You have to be pretty optimistic and believe in fundamental change in order to become a green and stay a green in the current environment.
Yeah.
How did that come about that you jumped ship from the Dems and became a green? You're one of the few elected officials of the Green Party nationwide and certainly one of the most prominent African-American Greens.
Well, yes. Well, let me tell you about my relationship with the Democrats. Okay. Well, it's not been a very good relationship. Any time that I've run and won, whether I was a Democrat or a Green, I've never had the support of the town committee. And see, in the city of Hartford, unfortunately, because it's so overwhelmingly Democrat, and people in the town tend to vote for the party, not the candidate, the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan could come up here, take off his robe, put on a suit, get endorsed by a town committee, and be sitting in that council chambers. It is a sad comment, but it's true. Okay.
It's happened nationwide.
Robert Byrd. It's amazing. You know, I've never enjoyed the company of the Democratic Town Committee, basically because I'm not a swap politician. You know, I'm not going to say I'll do this for you if you do that for me. You know, I'm a good at a whole politician. So, and I know about compromising. You know, I'm not stupid, but I also know that there's a limit to compromising. And so I've never promised anybody a job, and you know, I'm not going to, you know, that's the kind of thing that the Democratic Town Committee, at least prior to this town committee, I don't know about this town committee, they say it's changed, but I don't know, you know, you have to believe that. But I've never been involved with that level of politics. So how did I get to be a Green? Well, I've worked with Greens on other issues, on issues of anti-war movements and education issues and environmental issues. I just never knew they were Greens. They never, you know, announced, just not a sign saying, I'm a Green. So, but then the Greens approached me about running as a Green. So.
So how does it feel to run the majority, be it an outsider?
I'm not an outsider because, you know, my constituents are Democrats, Republicans, Independents. You know, I mean, it certainly isn't the 7 registered Greens that get reelected to council, right?
That's right.
So I don't consider myself an outsider. And how has it been working? It's been work. It's work.
Well, you're certainly not an outsider because after this most recent election, you became a part of the majority in the council. How did that all happen? That's a fascinating story.
Well, let's see. How did that happen? Well, because the Democrats, being Democrats, they try to do a coup d'etat over the newly elected mayor, over a job. Mm-hmm. You know, the city manager. It's like, here we go. Did we say we don't do that? And so the mayor said, okay. Do you want to do that? Then I'll put my own team together.
Mm-hmm. And that's which has a Green, a Republican?
A Green, 2 Republicans, and...
2 Democrats.
2 Democrats.
Huh? Yeah. Now, no one thought that was going to last a year.
Surprise.
Surprise. What magic happened? I mean, is it just that...
Because we work hard together. We work hard together, and the commitment is to the city. It's not politics as usual. We don't play politics as usual.
What's going to
happen? Can you turn that off for 1 second,
sure.
Please? Because my allergies are going to get me.
Okay.
I hate this. What? Oh, okay, sorry. All
okay,
right, I'm ready.
That's fine.
Showtime.
So what do you think the next what do you think the next council is going to look like after the next election?
Any well, I really don't know.
No predictions?
No, there'll be 6 Democrats, and there'll be 3 others. Will the leadership that the mayor put together, leadership team, survive the next election? I doubt it. Because I think there's a movement afoot to, you know, go back to being Democrats. And that's one thing that I'm hoping, that will be done in moderation, because during this term we've been able to increase the number of people who are not Democrats on boards and commissions. We've brought different Democrats because it's like poltergeist or a recycling agent. They kind of keep coming back and back and back instead of opening the doors to other people to be involved. So we've done a lot with boards and commissions and, you know, really working hard to include people in the decision-making process here at City Hall. And the thinking is, you know, used to be, well, it's, you know, it's a, it has to be Democrats because it's the ordinance or the committee structure would be majority and then minority. Hartford has a majority-minority thing. But a majority could be six Greens. Doesn't have to be six Democrats, but people always thought, oh, it has to be Democrats, six Democrats because we're so Democrat. I don't know. Do I worry about it? What's going to happen next term? I don't know. Because I'm going to do my job whether I'm a majority leader or not. So it doesn't, you know.
Did you support the charter reform in this last, the strong mayor referendum?
Yes, I did. I've always supported charter reform. I've supported it when Carrie Perry ran, you know, supported it when Mike Peters ran, supported it when Eddie ran.
Now, at one point in the latest reform, one of the reform plans that got dropped was to have council seats that were sort of not ward, but neighborhood-based.
District elections.
And some people liked that idea. Because it felt that it tied someone on the council directly to that area, and people on the other side thought that that was a bad idea because it sort of brought back all the worst of the old ward politics that Hartford used to have. I'm wondering, what's your take on that whole, whether council members should be elected citywide or whether ward kind of council seating would be a good thing? Any thoughts on that?
Well, I support district elections, but what I couldn't support in this charter revision proposal is a non-guarantee for minority representation. This council, this charter revision commission wanted to proportionally decrease the amount of non-majority representation. So, I mean, in this town, what? We vote for Democrats. So there would be less voice on council than there would be. And I also disagreed with the notion of how the Charter Revision Commission intended to draw the districts. They wanted to draw the districts. And I said, oh boy, that ought to be interesting. I thought we should really get a demographer to come in here and wait for the census and, you know, really do it the right way instead of, you know, having, first of all, they wanted the council to draw it. That way, I think that was the first. And if the council didn't make it, then the mayor would appoint, the mayor could, come on. I mean, that's how much more political can you get than that? So I said, no, we can't do that. But would it bring back ward politics? Is there a notion in that simply because you live in one section of the city that you represent that section of the city? Yes, that exists without ward politics, without the actual wards. And that is a very wrong perception. And people should understand that, you know, I'm African American. Well, I'm American of African roots. I think that's another thing we got to talk about one day about how we label ourselves and really killed our culture. Anyway, and I live in the West End. But, you know, I'm not an American with African roots that only represents the West End. I mean, I have to look out for the whole city. That's my job.
One of the themes that we're exploring in the series is that the problems of poor, core cities have become so increasingly severe over the last 20 years as there's been deindustrialization and a lot of the tax bases have moved out of these cities.
Yep.
And part of the ascension to power of progressive coalitions in urban areas and progressive mayors is kind of bittersweet because they take over just at a time when there's nothing left. There's no money left to do anything.
Right.
And so the question becomes, how do we create a new kind of regional politics or state level politics that takes account of the fact that all the resources that we need to solve inner city problems are in a different place?
Well, I think we have to look at, and this is what I would thought, my envision. Now, let me get this clear. Horton Schaff, not Chef, Horton Chef. I envision a regional school system. I think that we need to talk about pooling resources as a region. I don't think we need as many mayors. I don't think we need as many council people. I don't think we need as many school boards. I mean, the problem with Connecticut is that it functions like 169 sovereign states, okay? And you can walk across Connecticut. I mean, we're not talking California here, people, all right? So, you know, we need to look at the fact that center cities basically have more people who are needy. So we have more need. We also have more people coming into our cities to work who leave. We also have pilot property, payment in lieu of taxes property. So we almost 42-43% of Hartford's taxable property is pilot. Churches, colleges, Trinity is one of them, okay? Hospitals, you know, nonprofits. So all of these buildings are state buildings, gobs of those. So the city needs to be looked at as the resource that it is, and people need, the region needs to help support what needs to be supported in the city. Because if the jobs keep going out of the city, then the people who come to work in the jobs in the city are going to be just as affected. And so, I mean, while I think it's what's sad about human beings is that we tend to not want to take action until it bothers you, me personally. I mean, it's okay if it's over there. I mean, I can deal with it. But that's just one of the sad comments on mankind.
So we got a lot of reform out of the Watts riots and the various race riots of the 60s, and it's hope we don't need to go back to something as severe as some kind of wake-up call.
Right. Yeah. You know, because actually, you know, that's what society kind of works against any kind of revolution, any kind of revolutionary thought, any creative anything, because, you know, people want you to be lockstep. They don't want you to challenge the status quo. And, you know, I mean, they don't even teach critical thinking to our children anymore. If you think about it, they don't do any of those things. We have digital watch. People don't even know how to tell time. Some of our kids, if you gave them a watch like that, they wouldn't be able to tell time.
Well, you know, it all started when McDonald's started putting pictures of hamburgers on the cash registers instead of making people count change and give change.
Yeah, know? It's just something.
You know, I mean, where do you start with that?
Well, I mean, I think right back where Chef is, you start at the education, and you start from early childhood education, and you go right through to make sure that every child is afforded an educational experience that will allow them to be contributing adults. And so I think you really can't get around that.
You're listening to Hartford 2020 on WRTC, the radio station of Trinity College. Hartford 2020 is a weekly program on the problems and opportunities facing the city of Hartford. On this program, you'll hear politicians and community activists, scholars and gadflies, and people from across Hartford's many communities sharing with us their candid opinions about how Hartford reached this point and where it's going. Guests include former city manager Al Ilg, Councilwoman Elizabeth Horton Scheff, former deputy mayor and mayoral candidate Bob Ludkin, Judge Raymond Norco, and labor leader Ed Vargas. Hartford 2020 is a joint project of Trinity College's Cities Data Center, the Office of Institutional Research and Planning, and WRTC. Your hosts are me, Jay Hughes, Associate Director of the Institutional Research and Planning Office, and Ivan Kuzik, Director of the Cities Data Center. For more information about upcoming shows or to listen to shows on the web, visit Hartford 2020's webpage at www.trincoll.edu, that's TRINCOLL, /departments/DPTS/IRP/, or call 860-297-2112, or email us at james.hughes, that's james.hughes@trincoll.edu. trincoll.edu. Stay tuned for more of our interview with Elizabeth Horton Scheff, the majority leader of the Hartford City Council and a member of the Green Party.
Hartford's kind of like so interwound with things. I mean, when you look, I mean, you talked about when the Scheff case started, 74% of students were sort of underperforming. In 2000, according
to... No, I didn't say that 74% of the students were underperforming. I said that the system was failing 74%.
I'm not, I guess what I'm saying is, you know, the outcomes are really a measure of the system. It's not that, you know, somehow Hartford is a concentration of students that don't have the intelligence or ability. I mean, clearly these are systematic failure. That was 89.
Mm-hmm.
Those same conditions are happening today. In 2000, mm-hmm. The Hartford Current published a statistic. They gave the Board of Education gave a reading test to ninth graders in Hartford and found more ninth graders reading at a third grade level than a ninth grade level. Now you can't blame a kid who's been in school for 9 years for not being able to read. I mean, that is a systematic failure. But what I've found in doing this is that, you know, one thing leads to another. You know, I mean, in education, a lot of times, kids that do well, their parents were more educated, had books in the house. Mm-hmm. And you have in Hartford, if you believe some figures, 41% of adults who don't have a high school degree.
Yep.
40% of people who are reading at the lowest level of literacy competence.
Right.
So what I'm wondering, and this is always what confounds me about the city, is, you know, the kids need it the most because that's the next generation. But the parents need it.
Of course.
I mean, how do you not address all of these issues? You know, I mean, one thing runs into the next. At any one time in Hartford, 3,200 men from Hartford are in state prison.
Isn't that horrible?
That's industrial scale.
Uh-huh.
Now, when you look at sort of how many families in Hartford are run by single women,
mm-hmm.
well, in theory, there's 3,200 men that should be sort of at home head and families who aren't.
Right.
And now you look at children who were living in houses with a single family, with a single earner, a single mother. And those kids we know don't do well in school. So, you know, where do you attack that problem without going the whole way around?
And
20 years down the road, creating that next generation of 3,200 men that are ending up incarcerated.
Okay, wait. Okay. Scared of the generalizations, because I think that you're right, but you can't blanket. You can't blanket, all right? Okay, I'm a single mother. I raised my kids, okay? My kids did very well in school, okay? I did read to them. You know, I'm an avid reader. You know, I believe that parents do have a responsibility. Just like children have a responsibility. I mean, I always tell the young folks that as an advocate for education reform, that it's my job to keep the door open, but it's your job to walk through it. But, you know, having, single, women-headed families is people say that, you know, that's one of the reasons why, so many negative things happen. And as a feminist, I take exception to that. But, I also agree that there's some substance to that.
Well, I'm not attacking it from sort of an anti-feminist perspective. I would say not female, you know, a lot is made of female-headed households.
Mm-hmm.
Single-headed households with children do economically much worse because increasingly in America, you need two incomes.
Right. Yeah.
So what happens is it's not a woman issue or a man issue. It's a thing that what it takes to raise a family in America today is increasingly two incomes.
Right.
And if you have one income, the way that the distribution of wealth is, the chances are you're not going to have enough to be able to do it. So I didn't mean to imply that I was talking about, you know, sort of this cycle of female-headed households.
Mm.
What I'm really talking about is kind of a way where we have all these problems laid out in Hartford where there's a lot of need.
Mm-hmm.
And in my own mind, I can't put down whether you have to sort of attack a broad front or whether you can just do it alone in education.
No,
it can't be
just education. You know, I think that education is a key, but people need a living wage. You know, they need healthcare coverage.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, they need to feel like they can contribute. So it's not just one or the other. I think as a nation, we don't pay attention to the whole person. And we as much as we espouse family values, we don't do enough to support the family unit. Okay, so I ask guys, why are you my local entrepreneurs? Why are you doing this? Why is this your job? Well, I can't make any money. I mean, I tried working at McDonald's, but you work at these low-end service jobs, and they only give you 10 hours a week, or, you know, they hire like 99 people for one unit. Yeah. And they don't have to pay insurance.
Healthcare. One aspect of the Greens platform that I'm totally in support of, and I teach a course at Trinity on health and drug policy. Mm-hmm. And the Greens have been advocates of drug decriminalization and a rethinking of our drug war. I know it's not a policy issue that comes across the city council very often, but in terms of your own thoughts about, and African Americans have been kind of ambivalent about this, because on the one hand, they're often very hard hit in their communities by drug crime, and so they've often supported very draconian legal measures against it.
Right,
but on the other hand, it's the drug war itself hurts African American communities.
Right. And I think that's the dichotomy that you have to really look at, because first of all, let's be real. The economy of nations is based, and several are based on the drug trade. You cannot tell me that the United States, with the capacity to take a picture of your license plate from a satellite in the sky, cannot figure out who's running drugs in this country. Okay, somebody's getting paid. Right? So, you know, I agree that the laws are harsh, and you know they just put people in jail. And that we ought to look at some other way of doing this. When you say, you know, decriminalizing, you know, drugs, people go bonkers. But at one point, alcohol was, you know, considered an illegal substance. So, I mean, why not? I mean, if you look at it, why not decriminalize, you know, drugs? I mean, I'm not talking about, you know, just go crazy with, what is that stuff the kids take?
Heroin, crack,
ecstasy
and stuff. Yeah. See, some stuff we gotta, you know, we gotta be careful with some of that stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, but if people are gonna do it, then register them. I mean, it's a loss of a civil liberty, if you ask me. But if that's gonna be the case, then register them, tax it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well,
you go against the money, you end the drug war. You know what I mean?
Right.
You end the whole problem.
You take the money out of it.
You take the money out of it, you end the drug war. And somebody, they don't want the drug war to end. Mm-hmm. And I keep trying to tell these, I said, you know what? I don't know. I went to talk to these kids. And I said, you know, I don't know why you think that owning a Lexus and riding around with all that gold hanging off of you is where the money is. I mean, because you're the first person that's going to go to jail. You see, if I was going to be in the drug trade, I'd be the distributor's girlfriend. I'd be at the poolside. I didn't see a thing, sir. Oh, that boat right there. I never went in the hull. What? You know?
So how's that work with them when you tell them this?
They crack up. They start laughing. They think it's funny. But I say, I'm serious. You guys need to stop being pawns, because that's what you are. You're pawns for these people who are sitting over here making me, you know, we don't own boats to bring this stuff in. You know, we don't own chemicals to change poppy into cocaine. You know, I'd ask Union Carbide about that, you know? So I say to them one time, I was at this thing, we were arguing about it, they were saying about Union Carbide, and somebody was there representing them. And I said, well, tell me, how do you figure that your company's not involved in the drug trade? And they said, well, you know, we keep close tabs on that chemical, and we know that what that is only being used for its purpose. I said, and what purpose would that be? You know, I mean, so it's just ridiculous. You know what I mean? People are, and that's what I'm talking about, critical thinking. People don't think. They don't think. It's like, you know, like, where's the bigger picture? You know, can't you see the writing on the wall? I mean, I just think it's, you know.
Where's Hartford going to be in 20 years? Is it, given the changes in ethnicity, given the changes in the economy, given the fact that, you know, Bush is in office right now, if you, I know you could be utopian about it, and you said earlier you're hopeful, but what's the parameters of the way that you think things are going to change?
The parameters of the way, well, let me start with your first question. Where's Hartford going to be in 20 years? I am an optimist, but I'm also a realist. I think Hartford will be all right in 20 years. I think Hartford will be survive the economic downturn. I mean, the cycle, we'll make it through. We've done it before. We'll do it again. But I think that depends upon the kind of government and that's elected in the city of Hartford, how much that government is willing to push the envelope on things in demand. And it also depends on the residents of Hartford and how much they want to participate in democracy and demand, you know, what's rightfully ours. So, I mean, I think, you know, I'm always going to say, you know, if it rains, as long as I'm breathing, okay, I'm not going to cry about that. I do think though that, as residents, as people who live here or work here or worship here or, you know, play here, that we all need to, you know, work together to make sure that Hartford survives. We can do it.
You're listening to an interview with Elizabeth Horton Scheff, the majority leader of the Hartford City Council and a member of the Green Party, on Hartford 2020.
Having worked in the neighborhoods and as a community organizer for all these years, do you feel that sort of the level of neighborhood and community and sort of resident, you know, sort of activism or awareness is better than it was 10 years ago?
No, it's horribly worse. It's horribly worse. You know what? When I was growing up, you know, my mother worked. She worked a lot. And we had neighbors watch us. Then we knew our neighbors' names, right? And if we got in trouble, Miss Bansovich would spank us. And then she would tell my mother. And when my mother came home, we'd get another spanking. So while that entailed, DCF, two whippings, it proved to us somebody cared about us enough to want to take care of us and just tell us that you're doing something wrong. Nowadays, people don't know each other. You have neighbors who live next door to neighbors who never speak. We've isolated ourselves into our own little family unit, whether it's one, a unit of one, or a unit of 12. We're all kind of not, you know, paying attention to the fact that we're not islands. So one of the things that we've done here, this administration, is kick off a campaign on civic pride, and I've been really heading up that effort for the city to encourage people to get to know one another. I mean, speak. I mean, how many times you walk down the street, people don't even speak anymore. I mean, it's so sad. But, you know, get to know your neighbors, come out and work on making Hartford a better place. So civic pride, the campaign on civic pride is one way that we're trying to address the lack of connectedness in the neighborhoods and, you know, people next door.
What's next for you?
Excuse me.
You're going to stay in politics. And
I guess so. Yeah, I guess so.
Running for governor, running for
Senate.
Well,
you know, one of these days I want to run for probably, you know, I wouldn't mind running for governor one day.
You want to kick that off now?
Right now?
Yeah, start looking for money right today.
That's right. Start looking for money because I'd make a good governor. I am going to run for re-election. I am been supported by the Greens I have my Democratic supporters want me to seek the cross endorsement of the Democrats. And, you know, I will do it because my constituents asked me to do it and to prove to them that it's never going to happen. Because it just never ever happened. And never, the town committee never supports me. And no matter what, because I won't play that game again. I'm not going to say, if you give me the endorsement, I'll give your brother a job. You know what I mean? Don't do that. But I'm looking forward to, should the people choose, coming back, finishing up some projects that I have begun. One of which is very dear to me, is grandparents raising grandchildren. It's a phenomenon that's on the rise across our country. And here in Connecticut, it's on the rise. And here in the city, it's phenomenal how many. At the last census, I think, if I remember the number correctly, it was 1,250 households led by grandparents raising grandchildren.
What do you want to do for those households?
Well, what we've done is we have a grandparents program where we do seminars to help get information to grandparents, build support groups for grandparents, help them with legal issues. We're also working on a grandparents complex. And this, you know, housing, because housing is a real need for grandparents raising their grandchildren. I mean, if you're in senior housing and your child drops off the kid, you can't stay in senior housing anymore. You have to move. So we're working on a grandparents complex that would be specifically designed to meet the needs of grandparents raising grandchildren.
I think that's about all the time we have. We really appreciate your being with us today.
Oh, really? Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with Elizabeth Horton Scheff, the majority leader of the Hartford City Council and a member of the Green Party, on Hartford 2020. The following piece about Elizabeth Horton Scheff was published October 30th, 1997, in the Hartford Advocate, written by Paul Bass, titled Rebels with a Cause. Elizabeth Horton Scheff is going to church. She has on her two-piece black dress, green sash over her shoulder, white pumps on her feet. She puts on her wide-brimmed hat. She's going to church because it's Sunday. Sunday's been church day since she was a kid growing up in Hartford's projects. She's going to church for another reason, too. She's running for political office. Competent bank robbers who know their art know where the money is. Politicians who can win know where the votes are. Such politicians usually have one of two labels before their names, Democrat or Republican. This year, Scheff has a different label, Green, as in Green Party. As in fledgling left-of-center party that holds no offices in Connecticut, as in followers of consumer advocate Ralph Nader, as in white people. Scheff is black. That's rare for a third-party candidate, even though one can argue that strictly on issues, many blacks have certainly expressed feelings differing from party establishments. That's just one of the ways that Scheff breaks the stereotype of a third-party candidate. Scheff has held office before as a member of Hartford City Council. She knows poverty not just from books, but from living it. She knows how to clearly make a political argument and remind people to pull Road D in a radio interview. And unlike your typical local third-party politician, she has statewide name recognition. She's the mom of Milo Scheff and the public face and passionate voice of the landmark civil rights suit that bore his name and successfully challenged racial and economic segregation in Connecticut public schools. Yet despite her name recognition, she's running not for an unattainable high-profile job like mayor, which she tried once, but rather for a city council seat. Even her foes believe she has a good shot at winning. She's running with and promoting a slate bound to a coherent agenda. She and the slate have unions behind them, all 12 municipal unions, unions that don't gamble their members' livelihood in parlor game politics. Plus, Scheff goes to church. She knows the usher. Yes, right-wing Pat Robertson-style evangelicals do too. They, too, get involved in elections. Most third-party types, especially on the left, spend about as much time praising Jesus or Hashem as they do the Republicrats. More important, despite intentions to the contrary, most left-leaning third-party candidates live in a world that rarely intersects with mainstream America. The Gospel Lighthouse Apostolic Church is in full God-fearing frenzy by the time Elizabeth Horton Scheff slips in. Usually she attends Warburton Community Congregational Church, the one she grew up in, where her sisters still sing in the choir, where the social hall is named after her mom. The UCC church is more her style anyway, with its history of civil rights activism. Today, though, a woman who works on Schef's campaign, Deborah Murray, has invited her for a friendship Sunday. Murray moved to Hartford 6 years ago. She saw news coverage about Schef versus O'Neill, called Elizabeth Schef to offer help. Schef first met many of the people in this campaign, Greens, neighborhood people like Murray, through the lawsuit. Now Murray is working on her first political campaign, dropping Green Party flyers, encouraging friends to vote, working the phone bank. Today she wanted her fellow congregants to see Schef in person. She greets Schef as soon as the candidate slips into the middle of the church's half-filled wooden pews. Murray is one of the white-dressed women with blue usher ribbons. After a rousing hymn, Bishop Winfred B. Hamlet launches into a sermon on family. His volume grows, his words run on faster, as he exhorts people to come up and proclaim their part in Jesus' family. As Hamlet describes Jesus' humble beginnings, he could have been born in the state house, he could have had servants around him. He punctuates each rapid-fire string of words with deafening inhalations of deep breath, backed by R&B-style seventh chords on the organ and shouts and hand-raising from the pews. Schef fits right in. She calls an occasional assent. She likes the emphasis on humble roots, on the dignity in advocating for the poor. Even after the national glow of attention from the Schef case, even as she visits this past week Harvard to deliver an address on school desegregation, she continues living in public housing in Westbrook Village, where there's no doorbell to announce your arrival. You have to depend on someone in one of the apartments seeing you outside the window and letting you in. Old soul and classical LPs crowd the inside of Schef's apartment, sharing precious book space with Proverbs and the modern civil rights classic, Parting the Waters. Unlike when she was growing up, Schef could afford to live elsewhere. She makes $31,000 a year as a program manager for a private not-for-profit group that helps poor people figure out how to use managed care health insurance. I like Westbrook Village, she says outside the church. Everyone has a stereotype of women in public housing. They're all on drugs and unemployed. We have a man living in the apartment, not on the lease. I'm proud of where I live. I work hard. I'm president of the Tenants Association. I should be so lucky, she adds. I'm looking for that man to be on the lease. Inside the church, the service concludes with the parade of congregants, including small children, approaching the altar for baptism. They then, along with the rest of the congregation, follow evangelist Linda Hamlet in a parade out the rear doors. Afterwards, in the refreshment room, Schef waits for others to approach her. Overt politicking would be tacky. She hands her pile of flyers to Murray, who will distribute them later in the week, at Bible study. Munching on white bread tuna fish sandwiches, Schef reflects on life as a symbol. As state poster mom for school desegregation during the Schef case, she received death threats one day as she prepared to testify on a state legislative hearing. Two Hartford detectives accompanied her to the Capitol. She saw a beefed-up patrol of troopers waiting her at the doors. I said, I feel like Whitney Houston, she recalls, leaning back laughing. My family didn't think it was funny. But I think if you believe in something, you got to be willing to die for it. I don't want to die, but my soul is right. I tell my children, don't spend that insurance money on a mahogany casket or flowers. Have a party. Make it BYOB. Put that money to good use. They hate when I talk like that. Now a symbolic leader in a quest for political reform rather than court-ordered educational changes, she doesn't receive death threats. This isn't life or death stuff, though it does matter. She's already served two terms on the city council as a Democrat from 91 to 95. She began serving in the dying days of the People for Change slate that held a majority on the council, some as third-party candidates, some as party-endorsed Democrats. Like the current Green Party slate, People for Change attracted labor and minorities to a coalition determined to take the city's agenda away from large corporations and Democratic insiders. Schef saw that coalition die. She faults it for allowing people in power to co-opt office holders, splintering the coalition by hobbling its ability to back a unified agenda. This time around, she says, the Green candidates meet or speak in a conference call every 3 or 4 days to hash out issues and strategy. They're learning how to disagree and still act in unison, she says. Schef ran for mayor in 1995 against incumbent Mike Peters, first in the Democratic primary, then as the third-party pro-Hartford independent. She raised issues and was trounced by a 3-to-1 margin. Now she's running to win, with the mostly black and Hispanic remnants of the pro-Hartford group merged with the white Greens and the unions. She doesn't have to beat Democrats. Hartford's charter guarantees 3 of the 9 council seats to a minority party. The current minority party, the Republicans, have little clout or deep backing. 3,500 votes is all it takes to uproot them. A lot of votes for a fledgling party, but not too many for a smart one.
In 1996, the Connecticut Supreme Court ruled in the case of Sheff versus O'Neill, finding that Hartford schools, because of their racial, ethnic, and economic isolation, failed to provide students with substantial equal educational opportunity under the state constitution. The Sheff case had been filed in 1989 on behalf of 17 children. The 1996 ruling overturned a previous ruling in 1994, which went against the plaintiffs, saying that they had failed to prove that the state was responsible for segregation in the Hartford school system. The Sheff ruling has reverberated widely throughout the state. Although the ruling did not specify a remedy, state politicians sought to extinguish suburban unease over possible inter-district busing programs by addressing the racial imbalance in Hartford with a mix of magnet and charter schools. The original plaintiffs in the case returned to court in 1999, claiming that little had been accomplished to date. They sought the court's intervention in reducing the isolation and segregation of the city schools once again. In 2002, the plaintiffs in the state finally settled the case, and the state has agreed to put aside $44 million to reduce the racial and ethnic segregation of Hartford schools. In his dissent to the 1996 ruling, Justice Borden wrote, "There are no facts in the record to support what the majority asserts of the devastating effects that racial and ethnic isolation have on the plaintiff's education." Indeed, he wrote, "the trial court's findings contradicted that assertion. Under the facts found by the court, all of the adverse effects to the education of the plaintiffs resulted not from their racial and ethnic isolation, either in whole or in part, but from their poverty."
Hartford 2020 is a weekly program on the problems and opportunities facing the city of Hartford. On this program, you'll hear politicians and community activists, scholars and gadflies, and people from across Hartford's many communities sharing with us their candid opinions about how Hartford reached this point and where it's going. Guests include former city manager Al Ilg, Councilwoman Elizabeth Horton Sheff, former deputy mayor and mayoral candidate Bob Ludkin, Judge Raymond Norco, and labor leader Ed Vargas. Hartford 2020 is a joint project of Trinity College's Cities Data Center, the Office of Institutional Research and Planning, and WRTC. Your hosts are me, Jay Hughes, Associate Director of the Institutional Research and Planning Office, and Ivan Kuzik, Director of the Cities Data Center. For more information about upcoming shows or to listen to shows on the web, visit Hartford 2020's webpage at www.trincoll.edu, that's T-R-I-N-C-O-L-L, /departments/DPTS/IRP/, or call 860-297-2112, or email us at james.hughes, that's james.hughes, at trincoll.edu, T-R-I-N-C-O-L-L.edu.